environmental compliance plan required under this agreement, you know, will build upon things that Noble has now been doing since this investigation started.
A Shell oil contractor pays millions in fines in a plea agreement with the federal government. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, rallying for change in Anchorage.
Racism, sexism, homophobia, all these isms are still keeping us from working together for the collective good.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The Alaska U.S. District Attorney's Office announced today a plea deal has been reached between the federal government and Noble Drilling for incidents involving the drill ship Noble Discoverer and drill barge Kulik while under contract with Shell Oil during the 2012 Arctic drilling season. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
As part of the agreement, Noble Drilling has agreed to plead guilty to 8 felony offenses and will pay $12.2 million in fines, which are a combination of criminal fines and community service payments. The charges are a result of a U.S. Coast Guard investigation following an inspection of the Noble Discoverer in Seward. During the investigation, the Coast Guard found a number of maintenance and record-keeping issues. Yvonne Lamore is an assistant U.S. attorney.
For example, oil record book entries for the Noble Discoverer report that the oil water separator, or OWS, was used during periods of time when in fact the OWS was inoperable. In addition, Noble failed to record that the OWS was inoperable and failed to record that its oil content meter, which is part of that required pollution prevention equipment, was also non-functional.
Lamore also says Noble failed to log numerous transfers and storage of machinery space bilge water and waste oil. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kevin Feldis says Noble will also be placed on corporate probation for 4 years.
They will be under supervision from the United States Probation Office, and during the term of their probation, if they have any other violations of law, they could be subject to having probation revoked, which means that they could have additional fines imposed. Charges that may not have been brought in this case could then be, brought at a future time.
Additionally, Noble Drilling will enter into an environmental compliance plan, which Feldis says is meant to ensure incidents of this nature don't happen again.
After the investigation began, Noble, came to us and notified us of changes that were underway within Noble to, of course, remedy these criminal acts. And those have continued, and the environmental compliance plan required under this agreement, will build upon things that Noble has now been doing since this investigation started.
In a written statement, Noble Drilling says it has already begun enhancing training programs and compliance policies, as well as mechanical and operational upgrades to the Noble Discoverer. An independent auditor will review the plan and its implementation. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A draft socioeconomic review and traffic forecast for the proposed Kinnickarm Crossing project was released today by a trio of independent consulting firms. Cardno Consulting Services, Agnew Beck, and CDM Smith reported on separate forecasts for different aspects of the project. The findings were presented at joint meetings of two Anchorage Metropolitan Transportation Solutions committees in Anchorage. According to Bill Reed with Cardno Consulting, the bridge, assuming it is built, is not expected to have a strong influence on job growth on the Anchorage side and only minimal influence on the Mat-Su side.
There's modest net new growth that's created by the bridge, but by and large, it's much more of a kind of opened up kind of different locational options and business operation options for different industries. The weight of the evidence is that there's no major change to industry sector employment.
Travel demand projections were based on earlier studies and new updates, according to Hugh Miller with CDM Smith. Miller outlined three scenarios: no build, build no toll, and build with toll, and the projected effect on traffic patterns through 2060. That data was used in part to determine projected toll revenues.
We use the models to see what happens with different toll rates. So we tried from $1 to $9. and it behaves the way you'd expect it to. As price goes up, traffic goes down. As toll goes up, the revenue goes up, but at a decreasing rate. You can have too high a toll.
Miller's presentation showed $6.8 million in toll revenues for the year 2019. That's the first year the bridge would be in operation. The tolls would be $5 each way for a passenger car. The traffic and toll increases over the years would be based on growth at Point McKenzie, closest to the Mat-Su side of the bridge, since the only alternative for drivers from that area would be the Glen Highway. The data presented at the meeting is on the State Transportation Department website. No action was taken at the informational meeting. The shooting and choking deaths of unarmed black men that ended with no charges for the officers involved has ignited anger across the country over justice and fair treatment for all people. And in Anchorage on Saturday, a large group of residents took part in a march sponsored by the NAACP Youth Council that had a decidedly peaceful and hopeful tone.
Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot! Hands up!
Ashley Gaines is the vice president of the NAACP Youth Council and was born and raised in Anchorage. As she walked along H Street, she said no one is sheltered from events such as the shooting in Ferguson of Michael Brown.
As a young black woman, you know, I just know to stay on my P's and Q's and do what I am supposed to do. You know, I just have to keep on and fight for what I believe in.
The crowd was sprawling and diverse as participants carrying signs wound through downtown. Laura Avalenda Cruz carried her infant daughter. Her daughter's father is Colombian. She says she feels pain for black families who are afraid about their children getting caught up in bad situations and can't fathom having to worry every time her child leaves the house. She knows her daughter's skin tone will make a difference.
She didn't get her father's pigment, and that gave her a level of security and safety that a lot of mothers and fathers don't have when they let their kids leave the house.
Participants stressed there would be no violence in their march. Two officers stood in front of the federal building, but they looked relaxed, and one waved and smiled as people passed. Dexter Antoine moved to Alaska from Brooklyn in 1982 with the military. The 52-year-old father and telephone lineman says he's experienced institutional racism throughout his life, but he believes things are changing.
We're not going through nothing that nobody else has come before us went through, and definitely not to the extent that it occurred before. There are people dying, yeah. That's the struggle, that's the life. But hopefully, we won't have to do this more often over and over again. And sooner or later, it won't even be necessary.
Anchorage resident Cal Williams had the drum that kept the chants well-timed. Williams moved to Alaska from Louisiana in 1965. Growing up there, he was involved with the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, and says his grandmother wanted him to get away from the civil rights fight in the South. But he arrived in Alaska and became an NAACP president here. He says he feels there is not enough recognition of the struggle for equality, and some families have shielded their children from the past.
In doing so, we set them up for major disappointments when indeed they are confronted with some ceiling that they can't figure out why, can't break through, because we've not prepared them for that which does exist still, sadly, racism, sexism, homophobia. All these isms are still keeping us from working together for the collective good. And when we deny any one person their full potential, we rob not only that person of their contribution, but society from the contribution that that person could have made.
NAACP First Vice President Kevin McGee says he's glad there is a good working relationship with Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew for residents here. He says going forward, Alaskans need to stand up, speak up, and help kids, especially the ones having a hard time to stay in school.
And they're going to be the future leaders. So we've got to do what we can, our organization and any other organizations that wish to join us. We'd like to start a mentorship program to help the young adults, juniors, seniors in high school, those that are having problems in school, we like to see if there's anything we can do to help them so that they can graduate and move on to secondary schools and become the future leaders. So that's something else we're working on.
Marchers made sure Alaska's specific issues were not left out. The case of four young Native men who steadfastly claim innocence but are serving prison terms for the 1997 beating death of Fairbanks youth John Hartman were recognized on signs stating Alaska stands with Ferguson and the Fairbanks Four. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Shishmaref uses Operation Santa Claus to highlight environmental concerns.
The ocean isn't freezing. You start seeing sick sea animals and sick fish. That's our way of life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
A local skier was killed in an avalanche in the Alaska Range over the weekend. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the incident happened Saturday evening near Isabel Pass.
Alaska State Troopers tentatively identified the victim as 35-year-old Eric Peterson of Delta Junction. Troopers say they got a report of the death around 6:30 p.m. Saturday from the victim's skiing companion, 63-year-old Michael Hopper of Fairbanks. Hopper told troopers that he and the victim had been buried by an avalanche of snow near Rainbow Ridge, also called Rainbow Mountain, near milepost 205 of the Richardson Highway. That's about 10 miles north of Isabel Pass, about 60 miles south of Delta. Troopers say Hopper reported that he managed to free himself after more than 2 hours of digging and then began looking for his companion. He found his glove, then dug down further and found the body. Hopper said he made his way to the highway, flagged down a passing motorist, and called troopers, who responded, along with emergency personnel from Fort Greeley and rural Deltana fire departments, and a group from the Army's Black Rapids training site. Lieutenant Colonel Alan Brown is a U.S. Army Alaska spokesman. He says in response to troopers' requests for help with the rescue, USARAC sent out a team of five soldiers and two civilians from Black Rapids and a support team.
They took off within about 30 minutes, prepared to go assist the Alaska State Troopers any way that they possibly could. About 30 minutes later, the commander there at Black Rapids sent out another team of about six soldiers to prepare to provide sort of routine sustainment and logistics for the mission should it, you know, go on through the night.
Hopper was then transported to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital Saturday evening. A hospital nursing administrator says he was treated and released. Troopers say the snow in the area where the victim and Hopper were skiing is unstable due to recent heavy snowfall and is becoming more so. The news release says the agency was still trying to positively identify Peterson as the victim. A trooper spokeswoman declined a request for more information. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A Canadian company is exploring copper and zinc deposits at the Palmer Project site north of Haines. It's not even a proposed project yet, but it is already dividing the community of Haines. One group having a hard time forming consensus on the issue is the commercial fishing fleet in the Northern Lynn Canal. KHNS' Margaret Friedenauer has more.
Vancouver-based Constantine Metal Resources has found promising deposits at the Palmer site in the last few years and joined forces with a Japanese investing company. The site is about 40 miles north of Haines, near the Canadian border and the Klahini River, which drains into the Chilkat River. The recent developments have people in Haines staking out positions on whether a future mining operation would benefit or hurt the community. The Lynn Canal Gillnetters is an organized group that met recently in a closed meeting to discuss its position on the Palmer Project. It did not come to an agreement. Fisherman Norm Hughes was at the meeting.
We were split down the fence, like most issues in Chilkat Valley, whether it's fishermen talking about a specific issue or whether it's community talking about issues. And I'd like to hear more from the mine.
Will Prisciandero attended the meeting. He belongs to the Lynn Canal Gillnetters and is also the Haines representative on the board for the United Southeast Alaska Gillnetters, or USAG. He opposes having a mine near the Chilkat River because of potential effects on the watershed and salmon habitat. However, he thinks if the company keeps finding promising deposits, the mine will move ahead anyway. He says fishermen need to watch the project's progression, even if it's not yet in the permitting phase for a mining operation, so that they don't miss the opportunity to express their opposition and concerns.
I don't believe it's too early to start talking about it. There are not as many permits being applied for right now because the mine is in an exploration phase. It hasn't gone to a developmental phase or mining phase. So it's definitely something we should keep an eye on.
Bill Thomas is a longtime Haynes fisherman and was also at the recent meeting. He's less concerned about a potential mine at this stage of the process when there's so few details about what that operation would look like.
You know, I says, you know, Chicken Little's still alive. You know, and I says, we can't react to something we don't know about.
He says talk about acidic runoff or tailing dam breaches, like the recent Mount Polly disaster in British Columbia, are not relevant at this stage and only create fear. Alaska and U.S. environmental regulations are not like Canadian mining regulations, he says.
People are trying to compare us with the Canadians. Wrong. Canadians are less stringent on the EPAD restrictions. We're very strict.
Chris Sandero says even if some fishermen support the development of a mine, he would think they would want to advocate for the protection and safety of the watershed and salmon for the area's biggest source of income, commercial fishing. Haynes has nearly 180 skippers and crew who commercial fish. The industry landed $11.5 million in seafood in Haynes in 2012, and that meant about $326,000 in fish tax to the borough. Chris Sandero says if the Palmer Project becomes a mining operation, he wants fishermen to have input in the design.
If we can kind of get the best interest of the fish in the valley to protect them on water quality and any other parameters that might best management practices that the mine could entail up there to limit any impacts if the mine does go forward.
Thomas, meanwhile, says as resource extractors themselves, fishermen should not squeeze out other industries, especially one that promises local jobs.
And we don't want to be labeled as against other people to extract what they want, what they think is right. You know, we get to extract salmon. We sometimes overharvest. Nobody, you know, we're not criticized for it when they don't meet their escapement goals. And then we end up having more impact on the resource than probably some resource extractors, and whether it's logging or mining or what. So that's why I just sit back and watch us see what happens.
Chris Sandero says if Lincolnell Gillnetters is able to come to an agreement on a stance about the Palmer Project, USAG will also likely weigh in. The issue is on the agenda for discussion at the next USAG board meeting. Other state fishing organizations may also become involved if the local fishing fleet takes a stand either way and asks for support as the project continues to move toward development. Reporting in Haynes, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
When David Mahaffey was installed as the Orthodox Bishop of Alaska in a ceremony in Sitka this past February, he became the 16th leader of America's oldest Orthodox diocese. Bishop David has now been on the job for 9 months. He returned to Sitka this fall, and KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz spoke with him about the role he thinks his church should play in the state.
Under the Julian calendar, St. Michael's Feast falls in late November. It was a natural time to return to Sitka and to St. Michael's Cathedral, where David Mahaffey became Bishop David of Alaska last spring. But traveling is nothing unusual for this bishop. He leaves his Anchorage home almost every weekend to visit his scattered flock.
We go back to the word spoken by many, many years ago in the early church by St. Ignatius of Antioch, who said, Where the bishop is, there is the church.
Which in Alaska can be uniquely difficult.
Well, there's three challenges in Alaska. Distance, and distance. And did I mention distance is a challenge?
Bishop David served as administrator of the diocese for about a year before being installed in his new role. He says that for the most part, his job is simply continuing to do what the church has always done.
By and large, for me anyway, the Diocese of Alaska is a very much a very traditional, well-oiled Orthodox machine, which the bishop just has to sort of take his hand on the till and keep it in the right direction.
But he would like to see his church play a larger role in dealing with some of the big issues facing Alaska, including the state's high rates of suicide, alcoholism, and domestic violence.
We have to be here for the needs of the people. I can't be saved without you, and you can't be saved without me. That is an underlying principle of everything we do as Orthodox Christians. And we understand that we need to bring our neighbor along with us if we're going to enter the kingdom of heaven. We can't do it alone.
Bishop David says he thinks the Orthodox perspective has something to add to traditional clinical approaches when it comes to issues like addiction or depression.
And when I say that, what I mean is, in Orthodoxy, we don't look at people. We never like to use the word individual. Individual, it isolates you. It makes you nobody but yourself.
That importance of community is one piece of it. Another is a sense of purpose.
And the idea or the role of the church is to show the person how God made you for a reason. And you might have to spend your whole life figuring out what that is. Do you think that I, 20, 30 years ago, if someone would have said to me, you know, someday you're going to be the bishop in Alaska, I would have laughed at you. Because I'm from Pennsylvania, and I liked Pennsylvania just fine, but this is what I felt called to do. And so my goal is always to find that person and help direct them to say to them, you have a purpose in life, and your job, if you will, is to find out what that is.
As for the bishop himself, he says that though his calling was unexpected, so far it suits him. As an East Coaster transplanted to the last frontier, he's surprised by how much time he spends on planes and how little in cars. He's learned never to schedule distant events back-to-back in case the weather intervenes. And he's beginning to recognize the different tunes used for hymns in Alaska's distinct regions. But he says, at the end of the day, Orthodoxy is, well, Orthodox, no matter where you go. It's the same liturgy, he says, done in Russia, done in the Middle East, and of course, here in Alaska. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
For the last 58 years, the National Guard has brought presents and holiday cheer to remote communities across Alaska as part of Operation Santa Claus. But as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports from Shishmaref, the festivities over the weekend also draw attention to the serious environmental challenges rural communities are coping with.
Just to be clear, Operation Santa Claus is a massive undertaking, requiring months of coordinating to bring dozens of volunteers, military personnel, presents, and ice cream hundreds of miles. To do it, they use a C-130, the same plane paratroopers jump out of during war. There's also a small battalion of volunteers who organize the event every year. They got a later start than usual this year because of the budget sequester and scrutiny over misconduct within the Guard. But Saturday, partners from the Red Cross, Salvation Army, and Anchorage businesses helped guardsmen unload 2,500 pounds of donated cargo from the plane's giant ramp onto a local fleet of sleds and snow machines at the runway in Shishmaref. That cargo included a small brass band that performed traditional Christmas songs as presents were piled atop tables and bleachers filled in with families. But it wasn't the only traditional music performed. Soon after an invitational dance that brought soldiers in fatigues up to the floor, Santa and Mrs. Claus made their debut, posing for photos while their helpers guided kids to the gift tables. In addition to toys, there are practical items like 1,000 donated backpacks that third grade teacher Donna Bennett appreciates.
The backpacks, from a teacher's point of view, I love it. It is very windy up here, and when we try to send things home at the end of a day, we want it to get home.
Beyond material support and good cheer, Bennett says bringing the focus of so many people all the way to Shishmaref is an important aspect of the event.
it's exciting to see all of these people coming into Shishmaref so that they know that we're up here. We're up here. We do exist. We do have some issues that we need the outside world to see and to hear about. And if there's help available for different things that we do need up here, this is growing the awareness.
The biggest issue facing Shishmaref is the accelerating pace of coastal erosion threatening the thin barrier island it's built on. With climate change delaying freeze-up in the Bering and Chukchi seas, Dennis Davis says the false storms slamming the region each year present a danger that weighs heavy for many.
It's all the villages on the coast that are dealing with this climate change issue. I mean, it's going to affect our culture. It is affecting our culture in a big way as we speak now. The ocean isn't freezing. You start seeing sick sea animals and sick fish. That's our way of life.
In selecting where to bring Opsanta each year, the board works with the state's Office of Emergency Services to identify communities that have been hard hit. This year's site choices, Newtok and Shishmaref, highlight that even without a particular disaster, climate change is creating serious and ongoing hardship for coastal and river residents. And unlike an earthquake or a flood, there's no end or rescue in sight. Davis says, on top of the ice cream sundaes, he's glad Santa's cadre of volunteers can help bring the community's needs into sharper focus.
I just want to say thank you for them to come out here, take the time, you know, to come out and see our village. And it puts a lot of smile on people's faces because, you know, it's stuff like this that our people need to get our voice out there to let everybody know that, you know, we have a problem. We're not always looking for a handout. You know, we're a community that's basically washing away, and there's a lot of them that are washing away. You know, we need more action.
Organizers are quick to point out that Operation Santa Claus is not a charity. It's a goodwill event. And Davis thinks that's the right attitude to begin working together with outside partners, both to boost morale and to get to work addressing climate change. In Shishmaref, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, and Zachariah Hughes in Shishmaref. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.